Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. Before I introduce my guest for today, I want to remind you that the International Cultic Studies Association is going to be having a conference coming up. Some people are going to be flying to the conference. It's in Barcelona this year. And others are going to be participating online. I'm doing two talks that are put on video. So if you're not able to be there in person and you want to watch and sign up to be able to watch online, you'll see me talking about doing support groups specifically for people who have been involved in cults or in relationships with controllers and how you run them in a way that's different than support groups done for the general population. And there are going to be people talking about a whole variety of other subjects, former members, therapists, sociologists, clergy, people coming from a lot of different points of view and life experiences. And it's a wonderful opportunity to learn a lot, but also to connect with other people who have had similar experiences or who are interested in similar things as you. And so for today, we have Uriah Westman. Uriah is a multiple cult survivor and one-liner comedian turned comedic storyteller. Early on in his career, he was hesitant to speak about the cultic involvement of his childhood. But now, after nearly 8 years of performing and producing hundreds of comedy shows, he's found a way to transmute the pain of his childhood into laughter and catharsis. Uriah is now laser-focused on taking those darkest parts of his childhood and bringing them to light with his new one-man show called Three Cults Walk Into a Bar, where he brings levity to his difficult circumstances growing up in three different cults, being kidnapped as a child and recovering from a near-death experience. The debut performance of his show is on Saturday, May 11th at the Lyric Hyperion Theater here in Los Angeles. Definitely check him out. Here's Uriah now. I am delighted to have Uriah Westman with me today. It is so nice to be able to talk to you. I know this is going to be a great conversation. You have so many interesting things to talk about, and your take on it is going to be certainly your own and also filled with depth and humor, and I'm sure a lot of tragedy. It'll be all over the place. I'm sort of picturing sort of the faces of drama with the smile and the frown. I think it goes all over. So if you don't mind taking a moment to introduce yourself to the listeners, and then we'll start chatting.
For sure. Yeah. Definitely. Thank you for having me. Yeah, my name's Uriah. Quick basic intro is I'm a stand-up comedian who's working on a show about three cults. So essentially, there's no easy way to dive into it. So it's better to just dive right into it is to a point of like where someone can relate to is that if you like meet a stranger or you start going out with someone on a date, they always ask where you're from or why your parents had you, that kind of stuff. And for me, that's a difficult thing to answer because the reality is my parents were in an arranged marriage because they were in the Church Universal and Triumphant, where the leader, Elizabeth Clare Prophet, would proclaim individuals as twin flames, which is a cult version of soulmates, get together. And for them, she told them to have three kids and name one of them Uriah. So my soul identity of my name, Uriah, the thing that I originally get at birth, was not chosen by my parents, but chosen more by someone who I had no relation to and a total stranger, but that my parents idolized as if she was this magnificent being. But on the undercurrent of everything, she was very manipulative and later on just lied about everything. Her son basically said that she even admitted to that. And what she basically did is she would say that Ascended Masters were speaking through her. And again, Ascended Master would be like Jesus, Buddha, Christopher Columbus? Somehow Christopher Columbus is idolized by the cult? I don't get that.
Sure, why not? Yeah, throw it into the salad.
I, luckily enough, was not alive during the huge peak of the cult, which was in the 80s and the mid-90s, where it was very doomsday-centric. And what's important to note about what this cult did is, I don't know if this is one of the first ones that did this, is it mixed politics and religion in the one thing and made one of its strong points abortion, which is very much relevant today. Even so, that they would just like campaign for a specific president just on that one thing, but try to keep it more in lines with the cult, is that they would do these fast-paced decrees, prayers that still are in my subconscious that just pop in and out, where I haven't really been able to hear them again in my life until a little bit now. But even when I do, my body has kind of like the survival instinct where it starts sweating a lot, I get panic attacks, all this kind of stuff. So in the process of creating my show and just reliving this trauma, I cut out cannabis as a way that I was kind of just hiding myself from all the subconsciously stuff that I remember, as well as alcohol. So now not only am I having very vivid kind of nightmares and I'm confronting everything, but I think at the same time is I'm able to use humor as a means to kind of take back what it has done to me subconsciously and turn it around and make them the joke, which they should be. Because my mom, particularly my mom, had mental health issues. And with these decrees is they would almost become like a drug where you would have to do them. If you didn't do them, you would feel out of whack. And my mom would so religiously do them that if she was interrupted or anything like that, she would get angry at us. Almost like it was an inconvenience that we existed, but we only exist because the leader of the cult, the thing that you care most about, told us to exist.
Wow. Okay. So I want to jump in here, and I know you have other groups to talk about. During my formative years, because I started doing this work in the late 80s and early 90s. So I had a number of clients who had been in CUT, in Church Universal and Triumphant, and who had met Elizabeth Clare Prophet, some who had never actually met her, had just gotten involved, but found her to be quite hypnotic in her way, charming in one second, then intimidating in the next, very mercurial, intense person. And I remember hearing her daughter, Erin, I believe her name is speak at a conference or two, what it was like growing up with a mom like that. And I remember also studying about the doomsday prophecies and meeting people who had been building the underground, you know, shelters. What was also interesting about studying this group years ago was hearing the decrees repeated over and over again, and I will not do it, not to worry, but that it can sound like bees buzzing after a while. It doesn't sound like words. It does sound like people are being induced into a trance. And being induced into trance-like states is something that people can take on like a drug. And if it gets interrupted, it's like someone, you know, kind of interfering with your high or with the potency of the decree, and they have to start all over again. And so, yeah, anyone interfering, interrupting, making a sound is going to feel like they're in the way. And cults will often make children of people raised in cults feel like they are squarely between the children and the parents, that, you know, what happens in the cult is more important. And doing it just as the leader said, knowing that your origin story is tied in with this group and your name is tied in with this group. Also, I wanted to say that when I run my former cult member support group, there are a number of people who will say, would you mind changing my name in the box, you know, on Zoom, or just in your files if I'm meeting them in person? because the name that they were going by was the name given to them through another means, through another person, and it took on another kind of connection and meaning. And sometimes people will switch names to something and then sometimes switch again, kind of until they land on something that is that fits them, fits their life. And others hold on to their name because that's part of who they are, that they came from that origin. So I think identity and defining your identity plays a big role in coming out of these experiences. So I'd love to hear more about the other experiences that you've had.
So one of the the tenets that the cult believed is that there was humans on Earth that were actually aliens and demons in disguise that were fighting this war against God and the ascended masters. So after kind of the fall of the height of the cult is basically because my parents never loved each other, they wanted a divorce and no longer wanted to be together. So what my mom started doing is using the ideology of the cult and projecting it onto my dad. So what my mom would start doing is calling my dad a demon and he's trying to take us away, which was accurate. He was trying to get custody of us through the courts. But the thing is when you're a kid, you're going to accept whatever reality your parents are painting you. And if the people around you are telling you that demons are real and the nightmares you're having are legitimate, you're going to think this is real and it's going to get worse. So what happened and what this cult, I don't know if this was normal for people in the cult, but my mom would have a sword and scrape it down my spine to get rid of the demons. I don't know if anyone did that there, but so basically my mom would tell me those little scratches or little pins and needles that you feel around your spine, because that's where the light of your chakras are. Those are demons taking your light. So my mom would use a sword, scrape it down my spine to get rid of the demons. So it's like, if you were a kid and you thought there was a monster in your closet, if you had good parents, your parents would reassure you there's no monster in the closet. My parents would tell me there is a monster in the closet, and that's because I was listening to rock music. It's just like, and that's one thing about the cults. They believe that the beats of rock music, like the Beatles, are bringing darkness and energy. It's just, it almost sounds like, in that sense, like someone who's watching the next generation and being like, oh, they're nothing like my previous generation. Or it's almost like a grandfather-like way of thinking about things, that all because it's new, it's just weird. It would almost feel like, too, that demons make the best music then also. It's just like...
Yeah, they're very talented. Yes. It's an interesting thing, too, when you think about this sword going down your spine. That's chilling. And that sometimes people do get kind of pins and needles kind of a feeling, but it just means that your nervous system has been activated. And sometimes it's because you are feeling nervous. And it could be that you're feeling nervous because your mom is approaching you with a sword. It could be very pedestrian, right? Like, this is actually a tangible thing. Right in front of me is the thing that's making me nervous. It's not a possession. It's not another spirit. But yeah, there are a lot of other reasons given that underscore and to kind of support the worldview or the spiritual view. But I'm sure that was a very frightening thing to have happened to you when you were a child.
It doesn't make sense that I remember it because of how young I was. And another memory that doesn't make sense that I remember is with Elizabeth Clare Prophet. I mean, I must have been maybe 3, 4, but I think we're in the gift shop or whatever. But I remember is what her smallest toe was somehow all the way on top of her other toe. And that's something that stuck with me. And I'm like, the image of her foot just permanently etched in my brain. Luckily, it's not led to any other sort of I like feet now.
But right. No fetish.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yes. Why does this exist, though? Mm-hmm. And what's important to note for kind of the next thing I'll talk about that makes sense is she would say, the leader would say that angels want to help you. And there's a guardian angel that is going to protect you. You just got to ask. You got to, it would just be as basic as Archangel Michael, help me, help me, help me. And like, that's so unoriginal and ridiculous. But this would have been around 1999 to 2000. That's when we leave Montana and start, and we go to California, Santa Barbara, where again, the Church Universal has a chapter there. And unbeknownst to me is that we start moving place to place because my dad is getting jurisdiction to get custody of us. So my mom found out she can move jurisdictions and essentially was saying that our dad's a demon, so we're leaving to get away from him. And they would argue and yell, so this would feel real. This would make sense. So we end up in North Carolina, and we go school to school. But one school I went to, I ended up telling my first joke, and I was very accepted and really liked it. And I almost think if I would have just stayed in kind of that environment, I might have been fine. But somehow my mom got a job at a Montessori school, which is another big thing of this cult, is like this kind of the style of Montessori, maybe in terms, maybe it's like anti-authoritarian, which the cult was, which doesn't make any sense because she was very authoritarian. But what happened was, is when I was at this Montessori school, none of the kids were nice to me. It was, and I think it's because I had this shame and embarrassment constantly of just being around my mom all the time. She didn't have the social skills, I think. And I think what happens is when, especially in the United States, where there's no kind of like place to go, if you're looking for a group of people, the easiest thing to find is religion and cults. It's like, it's even when someone has substance abuse problems, somehow you go to those groups and God's involved. And I think she was just a victim of finally finding a group of people where she felt accepted in, regardless of whether or not they actually did anything for her. But what ended up happening is I befriending these older kids in the neighborhood that kind of bullied me a lot. And it turned into where I ended up being sexually assaulted by them.
Oh, no, I'm so sorry.
But I let my mom know, and she told me I didn't give the angels enough power to do anything about it.
Oh, no. That was her response to you.
Yes. So wow. So people victim blame, but she was angel blaming. It's like, well, what is this? So that's when the first thing I started to realize, that was my first kind of opening. And this would have been, I would have been like seven years old at this point. And this is when I first started being like, what's going on here? So we spend all this time at these retreats, at these conferences, all these decrees. Before we get in the car, we always do decrees so we don't get in a car accident. There's a very much a focus on death near constantly, where anything we do, if we go on a hike, it's just this weird obsession with the end times, which I feel like is that anytime there's a cult or anything, there needs to be something we're going towards. Otherwise, you just leave people. Same thing with a sports team. It's like you want to see it go the same way. Otherwise, you get disinterested. And that's what I think cults do. They pick a thing and then hopefully, and this to this day still, I can't believe it didn't turn into more of a violent thing at the bomb shelters, at the cult. It's because they had weapons. There's people arrested for trying to smuggle weapons. They had an armored personnel carrier, but somehow like nothing happened. Sorry to bounce around a lot. It's like
it's quite amazing. So I'm taking notes while you're talking because I wanted to get back to a couple of things. You know, when kids are raised in cults, they do feel like outcasts. It's really hard for them to connect socially with people. And then also their parents are a reflection of a different kind of way of thinking and living. And, you know, it's hard, especially if you're a teen, to have a family that doesn't fit in. And if you feel like you don't really fit in, you're also not going to understand a lot of cultural references and be able to do small talk because there's no small talk in cults, right? That's all about something important or the end times. And so there's so much that people feel where, you know, they feel like it is such a handicap to them. The idea of a Montessori school being anti-authoritarian, I don't know that part of it, and it could be. I know that it's a great educational system. It's ironic and not also that she would be okay with you going to a place that was potentially anti-authoritarian, because I think she wanted to be the only authority. And so if you went anywhere else and there was someone you would listen to and follow, then that would threaten her. And so, yeah, I think it would work for her ego that you would be in a place like that. And then I did a talk recently about when people leave cults and that they sometimes need to develop compassion after they leave, because it doesn't allow you to do that, or it doesn't help you develop it if you're born and raised in them at times, or if you get involved in them later on, you learn that things happen for a reason and it's the victim's fault usually. And so just like with your mom being, I think, kind of unmoved by you telling her this story that would typically make a parent very upset and protective and want to go, you know, talk to those people's parents or call the police. But instead, it got redirected onto you in what feels like a very punitive but distant kind of way. Like, oh, well, that's just because of this. So I don't really need to feel anything. I don't have to feel bad. I don't have to feel worried. It all makes sense. It's like this formula. Did you find that a lot with her?
Yes. Hugging wasn't really a thing that happened that much. We never said, I love you. We never really expressed feelings at all, I think. I don't even think I can like remember having any sort of conversation with my mom or any sort of like talks that you would have in regards to feelings or anything like that. Even during the custody battle stuff, it was always about getting us back and never about what was best for us. And this showed that she would hire therapists, family therapists, but not to like see what's wrong with us and fix that. It would be what my dad did wrong. She would have us not smile in photographs because she would say the courts would use that to show that we're actually happy with her dad. She had us fabricate a story that he was holding us over the pedestrian bridge on the Yellowstone River. She had this basically fabricated story that he held us over the river and was going to throw us into the river, which never happened. But at this point in kind of the story, to make this make sense, we leave North Carolina and move back to Montana. But I think moved would be a strong word this time, because we didn't really move anywhere. We moved into a motel in a motor inn, and my mom was telling us that Livingston, Montana is a gateway to hell. And the crooked Livingston Police Department is working with my dad and the courts to take us away, which is accurate because finally my dad was somehow able to get us back to Montana and get emergency custody of us. So my mom would have us randomly leave the motor inn and go sleep in a car. And I just wondered what was worse, sleeping in a motor inn or by a motor.
Right. Yeah. No, both are difficult.
So when we were place in school, I had the embarrassment of realizing that my level of education was very, very bad. I was unable to spell words, and to find that out in front of the class while writing it on a chalkboard is like this sense of embarrassment that has always like clawed onto me. And at that moment, though, as I realized this, if I use humor and tell jokes, people forget about what just happened. So I started using that more. And the first time I was called a class clown was like, that's my identity. That's how like people forget about everything else. And he just tells jokes. Do all the jokes work? No. But what happened is when I finally got a little bit of stability, my mom concocted a plan to take us out of school in the middle of the day and take us across state lines. And I didn't realize in this moment, I was kidnapped by my own mom.
Wow. And you are saying we. So how many siblings did you have?
I have two. I have a younger sister and an older sister.
Right. So they really followed the three children rule.
Yes.
Okay, got it. And so I'm wondering, you know, how it was for the three of you. I mean, kids sometimes can get very close when they, you know, go through things like this together. It can also break families apart. I'm just wondering how it was for the three of you.
It's hard to kind of know like their points of view, but my older sister doesn't remember a thing about our childhood. And my younger sister became the closest to my mom, so much so that she still does degrees. She's really entrenched in it still. Not in the Church Universal, but the Heart Center, which is the second cult, which is an offshoot of the Church Universal and Triumphant. That's run by David Christopher Lewis. Again, there's the pattern of the three names, because you had Mark Lyle Prophet, Elizabeth Clare Prophet. It was like they really like numerology and numbers and stuff. And my sister, I feel like, this is just my opinion, I feel like my younger sister recreated the childhood as a way to kind of deal with the trauma. She had kids, and then the same thing happened where child services came and took them away. And I was very happy about that because they're not living in a good environment. But the same thing my mom would say, my younger sister would say, almost verbatim about, oh, this is just, again, the demons trying to take my kids away. It's the same thing, but no responsibility being taken.
Right. The us versus them kind of mentality that people are out there trying to do harm. And yes, you don't have moments of reflection. And not to get too deep psychologically, but when you have these two siblings and one cannot remember, I think for a lot of reasons that are really very valid, that she can't remember a lot and she's stored it away somewhere safe, I guess, in her psyche. And then having a younger sister who's still involved, it's fallen to you to be the one who tells the stories, the one who can remember to a great degree what happened and remember the details and then can kind of testify about it to the world. And I know that that can be a big role. It can be a lonely place. And I hope that it also feels like you've taken this on kind of as an honor. Like here, I get to tell the stories and I remember the stories and I want to use them to teach people about what can happen. So I'm just thinking about how being the lone voice in this can sometimes be difficult, but it's also very powerful.
The idea that I'm using like stand-up comedy and standing in front of people talking about it, the irony of trying to get people to follow me and come out to my show is not lost on me at all. It's so odd to be like, oh, I have an Instagram account. I got to grow my following. It's like, this is not important to me at all. And especially when I first started talking about this kind of stuff on stage, I was like, when people come up to me and kind of talk to me, it felt weird because it felt like I was almost recreating my childhood where, oh, Uriah's talking. I don't know if this is like me just like subconsciously trying to distance myself from the trauma, but I almost like, it almost just to my point, I want to tell my story and be funny, but I don't want that idea of anyone to see me as anything more than just a person. The last thing I would want is anyone to like see me as some sort of gospel or something like that, which again is that, oh, is that, is even thinking that, it's just, is that then the ego in me? Is that just, it's just like, and then I'm like having all these back and forth conversations with myself out of something that's just a compliment someone's giving me. Which I think it's hard for me to process that. And I think that boils back to what we talked to before. It's like just the idea of saying I love you to someone is incredibly hard, or like taking a compliment. Normally that's when won't even say thank you, but I'll just say something back and just like forget that happened.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, what you're saying actually is very common, that when people, let's say, are raised by people who have more of a narcissistic part of their personality, they're then afraid of getting compliments, accolades, you know, people listening to them, or even if they want to talk about something that's on their mind, just that they're talking about themselves. They think they're exhibiting these same traits when they're not. because it's a disorder. And so they don't necessarily have the disorder just because they're saying, hey, look what I did. You know, it's not narcissistic. Same thing with coming out of a cult. When people became like, people have said to me, oh, I was given the job of being the spokesman for a company, and suddenly people are listening to me and it gets quiet as soon as I start to talk, similar to doing a comedy show. And you're thinking, oh no, this is a little too close, like a little too reminiscent. But it matters, I think, that the distinction is why you're doing it. It's not to control people. It's to be able to have people know you and hear you. And you get to be seen for who you are and get to share your stories. And you also get to educate people along the way without it being dry, you know, because comedy is a great way to educate people about things in an entertaining way. So I think intention, and that your intention is so different, then I hope it can free you to be able to feel relaxed doing this. Because I think it's great that you're doing it. And also with being ostracized for so long, why not have people say, you were great, or you're awesome, or it's so nice to meet you. I mean, that can just be very healing, you know? So I'm glad you're having those experiences.
What was wild is maybe about 2 months ago, I was doing a show, and afterwards people came up to me and they're like, oh, we're visiting from Seattle, and our sister, the same thing happened with the arranged marriage and the kids. And if this was like, oh, we're from the same like place, and oh, that's cool, but I find no comfort in knowing there's more people out there that have gone through the same thing, because I want to be immediately like, I don't want to be in contact with, I want to talk to them. But I get messages from people about how they were cults, all this kind of stuff. And that's where I think I really kind of feel like is that there's kind of like an underlying problem where if this is talked about, it's talked about more in a sensationalized way rather than kind of bring it down to what it's actually like for the victims of the cult. And that's why I guess I see in like documentaries and stuff like that. But to get DMs on Instagram and people come up to me, it's just like, I had someone who came up to me and they're still in like Scientology. They're like, I wouldn't call the call. I've been here 20 years. I'm like, God,
Yeah.
I find no comfort in knowing that how bad this probably is of how many people are in it. But it is kind of freeing to know that maybe the experience I went through might get someone out of the experience that they're in now. That's the change of perspective. That also kind of comes with having a critique and critical thinking, which again, something that was never promoted by my parents. And because if critical thinking just happened, like I don't think cults could exist, is that if everyone had like an equal opinion. And I think that's where kind of the idea of what's a cult and what's not a cult kind of happens, is when there's one person in charge and whatever they decide goes. And that's where kind of the second cult comes into fruition, and that's the heart center. And that was essentially a cookie cutter of the Church Universal and Triumphant. Basically, he proclaimed, and what's funny is there's an obsession of body of waters. So Elizabeth Clare Prophet said the first time Ascended Masters were talking to her when she was water skiing in New Jersey. And then David Christopher Lewis was standing by a creek, and they're like, you're the new person. It's funny that the Ascended Masters would be like, you're the new person to spread the word, but you're the new person that won't give how to cure cancer. It's like, why don't you give us something that would actually work?
Right, right. I think also sometimes people will say to me that I feel like my loved one is getting involved in something that's taking them down a bad path. You know, how can you tell that someone might be getting involved in like a very controlling relationship or in a cult group? And one of the characteristics that I point out is to watch out for is a loss of sense of humor, because everything becomes serious and everything has meaning and there's nothing to kind of laugh about. And also with the fragile ego of the leader, they might think people are laughing at them. And so they also can't handle people laughing. And so you also can't be the class clown in a cult, because then you'd be entertaining other people and you'd be the focus of attention, which also the fragile ego of the leader won't be able to tolerate. So the fact that you've been able to either claim or reclaim a sense of humor is actually a very powerful thing. And it, because it's so personal, and it is about critical thinking, because it shows that you can look at things in a whole other way and talk about it in a whole other way, which is very independent, very much about who you are. And so I wondered, now you talk about being in a couple of groups. So I would love for you to talk about some of your other experiences. We could talk about Church Universal and Triumphant a lot for hours and hours. But yeah, I'd love to hear about some of the other things that you went through.
Yeah. So the Heart Center, the offshoot, what he did is he would do these pilgrimages where you would just travel to places to cleanse the area of demons. And I went to Washington, D.C. in the wintertime. And so spoiler alert, no demons were cleansed. But so what he would do is there'd be these dictations where like Mother Mary, Jesus, Buddha, whoever would speak through him. And there was a, this is kind of the exact moment where I realized everything here was just garbage and like ridiculous, is that Mother Mary through him was going to tell us what came first, the chicken or the egg. And I'm like, okay, this is true. I'm a kid. I'm like, okay, let's figure this out. And the thing about these dictations, they would go on forever. Just, I have no idea when they're going to end. There's nothing worse than not knowing when you're going to leave a room. Except they're in the morning. It's just like, I'm a kid. And like at that point, I'm just like, I'm already not liking this, but I'm like, okay, this is interesting enough. And then after a while, he goes, the hen. And I'm like, nope. And I, anytime I think about this, I get a lot more angry than I should with that sort of thing, where it's because it's so stupid. Those weren't the options. But everyone, there's a round of applause and a palpable like gasp of, wow, this is like profound what he's saying. And that's when I knew this was all nonsense. And so the Heart Center is so very close to the CUT. It's almost like talking about the same thing. So the other one, this one is very odd. This was called the Ideal Society. And this was in Canada. So before that, I was in Montana, and I kind of saw Canada as my way of a new life. I really liked hockey. I ingrained myself in hockey, all this culture. So when I eventually moved to Canada, I could be a Canadian. And my dad was moving up there to build a house, and I was able to go up there. And I'm like, this is it. It's over. I'd no longer be a cult kid. I could just like talk about different upbringing. And I end up living on this cult. And it's weird because it still exists and people live on it, that I'm hesitant in calling it that. I don't know why. I don't know if it's just like something else that's hard to process, but I think it's mainly, to me, is because it was the Quebecois ideology where I didn't understand most of what they were talking about. But what I did notice is so they would have the temple where everyone would go and eat. And you would go in and you couldn't talk until the leader comes in, who isn't even the leader, because the leader is actually dead. But the person who runs it now is the leader, but does whatever the former leader is written. And no one would talk. And then she would come in, and when she starts eating, we could start eating. And then if she starts talking, we could start talking. This is, if anyone's seen like the movie Midsommar, it's very similar to that. And me, anytime like it's quiet and you can't talk, all I want to do is talk. And it's like the amount of thoughts that go through. But what happened though is, regardless of what they believed and everything like that, the reputation of that in the small Jaffrey village in British Columbia was, we're in it, we're a part of it. So when I end up going to school and they know that I live on it, it's, where I almost start being like, oh, it's not what you think. It's just they have goats, they're chickens. So it might be a little bit weird. But then I like, am I just now defending the cult? Does that mean I'm in it? And it's one of these things where I look on it. My dad just switched from cult to cult to cult, where now landed on QAnon Trump, where I think that's like the top of the mountain. There's nothing above that. And he gave tens of thousands of dollars, at least to this third one. And I could only imagine, because he was a communicant in the first one, which is a 10% of your money you have to give to them. But when it came to us, there was never any money. He would make us feel guilty if we left the light on. He'd be like, the bill's gonna go high. And I have this overwhelming like anxiety over money. And he always made it out to me that there was never money, but there was always money for the ideologies and the cults that he believed in. Always. And the third one is, I think it's because it's the most recent, is weirdly the hardest one to talk about. And I think it's because I had friendships and relationships with people there, which makes it interesting because there's the human aspect of shedding a light on a particular group where I'd be worried about like the repercussions of that, which I don't know if that's, it's hard to process what that means in the grand scheme. If there's still there's unresolved trauma for sure, but there's other stuff that I've just forgotten about that will resurface.
So interesting that your father, who was trying to protect you from your mother, then wound up in a variety of different kind of cult groups and now is involved in the kind of political, conspiratorial, all of it kind of thinking. So it sounds like both your parents are really vulnerable to just being taken over by ideas and ideals. The idea that there isn't enough money for the children, but there's enough money to tithe and to give to a cult or to a church, to an organization, also happens time and time again, where kids will go hungry. There's not enough money for education, for clothing, for all of it, but somehow thousands of dollars appear to give to a place usually that doesn't need it. And so I wonder then if we can talk more about this ideal society, because yeah, it's going to stand out. It's not linked to your previous groups. And the fact that you were there, you know, with other people kind of defending it and then kind of catching yourself like, oh, what is happening here? Why am I saying these things? So if you can tell us more about this group and the idea also that you can't talk until the leader talks and you can't eat until she eats, it's fascinating. Just shows the power and the control, the behavior modification, and who is the most important person in the room. So tell us about the philosophy, or is it theology, of the ideal society.
It had a lot of stuff of like going back to the land, all this kind of stuff, like self-sustaining, all of that. When kind of like going through this is, I didn't want to, if I didn't remember, unless if it was something that I didn't explicitly remember, I didn't want to research it and then all of a sudden learn about it more and then use whatever they believe and then put it into my mind and then put it out there. Because on the outside way of kind of looking at what they believe, I agree with so much of it. The back to the land, the sustainable. But what I don't agree with is that the amount of, I guess, the money you have to give to them, if you live on there, you have to be part of this ideology. And when there's a hierarchy in a community, similar to if you like lived in like a condo tower and you get on the bad side of the homeowners association or whatever, there's an imbalance of power in the group then. Is that if you all put in the same amount of money, all the same amount of time, everything, but somehow this person is more important than this person, I think that's when it turns into a cult is when this person is the most important and that's it. I think that's the issue with it. And this one was in French. So a lot of times I didn't know what they were talking about, but it was the vibe. It was the almost it would encroach into your subconscious that the idea of you as an individual is kind of removed, I would think. And even to this time, as I feel like I wasn't shown a lot of what they do, because I feel like I was never part of it enough for them to really get me in it. My dad was in it, but I was very much rebelling at this stage and kind of refused to go to a lot of like the things that they would do. But this one hurts me more in terms of just the idea that whatever people believe that this one is, that's what I am, and there's no shaking that. So it's funny to basically be like, short term, is I didn't look up what their ideology and what they want to believe, is because in the small part of what they do that I know, I'm okay with. I like it. But last thing I want to do is, especially when talking about this, to actually almost like, I guess, feel an over amount of sympathy for no reason, just because it might hurt people. I don't want to feel like I'm promoting an ideology that I might actually somewhat believe in and connect it to the ideal society, if that makes sense.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, there can be a lot of conflict when you agree with some of the things or many of the things that you're taught within certain groups. And sometimes it's that was the appeal of it. That's what drew your dad, let's say. Maybe he had similar sensibilities and interests or things he cared about. But in a lot of these groups, you know, they didn't invent these ideas. They're just incorporating them. So they can still belong to you. They can still belong to the world. They don't own them. And so I think it's sad to see when some people abandon ideas that really matter to them because it's too closely tied to a cult group that is using it for their own benefit. But yeah, I wouldn't want a group to take away your interests, the things that matter to you, but I understand you almost have to kind of wrench them away from these ideas. And so then, were your sisters involved in this or no? Or just you?
No. So at this point, my older sister would have been kind of on her own in Santa Barbara now. We're 2 years apart. At this point, maybe she was around like 15 or so. She dropped out of school, I think. And then my younger sister was just with our mom at this point. So basically, my dad did a thing where it's like, you don't want to live with me? Don't live with me. It was almost like because he had a new wife and new kids, all this kind of stuff. But again, like didn't take a second to understand that the best way to kind of put this is after I'm with my dad and then my stepmom, is I kind of felt like a ghost in the house, in the sense where I didn't want to be seen. But then it would be like, oh, who left these dishes in the sink? Who left these cupboards open? Who left this mess? It would be this commotion over all this kind of stuff. But my dad never took a second to realize that what we have gone through, where none of us are okay. And instead, it's like, this isn't how I was raised. So he pushed my older sister, was like, you want to drink, get out of here. So just kicked out. It was almost just, and I ended up getting kicked out as well after I was being charged rent and stuff. So no, my two sisters didn't really have much on that one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Wow. So that makes it a more intense experience for you if it's just you and your father also. And it can make it harder at times to leave because then you're leaving your father and you're the last one. So I'm just wondering about how you broke free from it.
So this is so ridiculous that somehow this happened, but I end up going to a private school in Fernie, which is like 30 miles outside of Jaffrey. as kind of like a charity case in the sense that they needed a certain amount of kids in the school to get funding from the government. And it was learning that was so far from what I knew that I don't even know how I got through these grades. I was a total class clown when there's seven kids in the class. But what happened is I befriended another kid in the class and basically kind of let them know what was going on. And for a short period of time, I was able to actually live with them away from my dad and go to the school. But like when you're sharing a room with someone, especially in your teenage years, eventually it just like doesn't work anymore. Part of that also was that they wanted to get custody of me so my dad would have to pay child support. And I don't want three moms. It's like, again, it's like the idea, okay, the amount of times there's threes now, and all of a sudden, now three, it's like, this is, no. So because of that event, I end up back with my dad. So this, I'm in grade 12. I'm now at this point having to pay for my education. I have a full-time job at A&W, a fast food restaurant. And I'm driving back and forth, paying for all my bills, all this kind of stuff. Again, though, it just doesn't make any sense that I'm having to do all this. And eventually, I'm unable to pay for everything and the rent. So I drop out of school to do that. But because I drop out of school, my dad doesn't want me to live there. So I end up outside the house. So that's kind of when I just cut out all contact with my dad. And really then go into just kind of a spiral of just drinking and hanging out with people. And then I moved to Victoria, British Columbia, Canada, where I fall in love with someone in a punk band, which is funny is because I kind of end up revolting against like the idea of my dad and stuff when I wasn't a teenager, but more of an adult. It's like, I'm listening to rock music now, I'm doing all of this. But the idea of a twin flame stuck with me because it was reiterated all the time. So I thought this person I fell in love with would be someone I would be with forever, which is, it's naive to think now because of how young we were, all this kind of stuff. But when we broke up, it turned into a thing where I didn't know what I was doing in my life anymore. And I always wanted to do comedy though, but there's no guide of what to do. So I end up going down to Portland and I end up befriending some people at a hostel and we go to see a comedy show. And the comedy show is so bad, I'm like, I can do this. And so I wrote some jokes, did an open mic, and just had an epiphany that this is what I want to do. And I think I took from my parents is that if you really love something, you have to go all in. They went all in on a doomsday cult. So yeah. I decide, and so psychedelics at this point were like I didn't do them a lot, but a way for me to feel an oversensing amount of joy sometimes. And I think it was used therapeutically. But I did that to have epiphany as like a guidance of what I was going to do in my life and decided that I need to quit my job now. So I quit my job at this call center job that somehow I was good at selling work, cable internet to people. I don't know how I have that. But I quit my job and I go on to open my comedy tour where my car breaks down and I've actually end up sleeping in a tent in the backyard at my parents' that I intentionally did not want to see again.
Wow. Wow.
And I start reliving all this trauma and stuff. And I would have been 24 and I still had the habit of sucking my thumb. And I've been trying to get rid of it for a very long time. And the thing about that habit that sucks the most is there's no better way to say that habit. I Googled it. And it's the medical term is a non-nutritive sucking habit, which sounds worse than calling it. It's like, what is this? But
got it.
Mm-hmm. It was through going back and kind of reliving. So this is where my mom lived and my younger sister and my older sister. There's the chaotic environment, but somehow because I was so entrenched in what I wanted to do, I'd still hear the decrees, all this kind of stuff. But this is what I wanted to do. And somehow that habit of sucking my thumb that I tried years and years to get rid of just disappeared.
Wow.
And I tried to talk about the cult stuff all down stage, but it's so hard to talk about that and then go back to living at it. Just like it's hard to joke about living in a tent while living in a tent. But I talk about the universe, not that there's actual plan, but there's something oddly poetic that I go through all of this, but in order to finally get to tell my story, I end up back to where it all was, more mentally ready to confront everything, but then kind of take everything and turn it into something that's able for me to talk about that's trauma-based and then turn it into comedy. And then that's where I think it really flipped the script on everything, where it wasn't people laughing at me. It was me making people laugh at the cult. And that's what I think is the most important thing.
That's beautiful. That's right. Right. So you took control of that situation. And I really like that. The idea of sucking your thumb, it doesn't surprise me at all that you would hang on to something that's self-soothing. That there is also something, it is hard actually to stop sucking your thumb because it's right there, right? It's not like if you smoke cigarettes and you run out, like your thumb is right there. So there is something, it sounds to me like you were trying to do that felt reassuring, that felt safe, that felt nurturing. And if you weren't raised with that, then you find a way to provide it for yourself. And then, so I'm wondering, when you said it suddenly just ended, what do you think that was about, that you didn't have the impulse to do it anymore or to need it anymore? Was that because you had found your passion, something that really felt satisfying outside of you, like your life suddenly felt good?
I think so. I feel like what I was able to do is find something else that gave me comfort that replaced that subconsciously. Because there's definitely, from when I was young to adult, it would just kind of creep in when I was sleeping towards like my older years of doing it. But it would still happen. I would be mad about it. But even sleeping, it disappeared. And I think it was years of determination, but I think what it actually was is that I finally took whatever was subconsciously the reason for it and kind of replaced it with something else that was more beneficial. And that's what kind of, I think, made it go away. I wish it went away when I was hiding it and trying to explain it to my girlfriend. That's a little bit, I wish it disappeared then. Maybe that's would have been my sign that we weren't the one. She wasn't the one because my suck in my thumb didn't disappear. It's like Cinderella's slipper. It's like, no, still suck my thumb. I gotta find someone else.
That's interesting, right? That's your gauge. Uh-huh. Wow.
And it, again, though, is even after a while of, once I left my parents and moved to New York, I just became a one-liner comedian. I still didn't talk about my story because it's still hard to write and all that, but I wasn't really fully comfortable with it and wanted to talk about it kind of until my mom died. So she died about maybe a year ago. And then I'm like, I want to talk about this now. I think it's because she was the one that was the most, my dad was just distant and reactionary in his parenting. Like, you're a class clown, you're grounded. You suck your thumb, I'm going to put hot spice on it so you don't. So it's very much, okay, maybe that's why I like spicy food. But, and this might feel weird to people, for me to say this, is I felt a freeing kind of cloud lifted when my mom died, because I knew that she couldn't hurt me like she did before again. She would go on these tirades, almost like it feels like a blackout, and just scream and yell, and would tell me, my sisters, if we disagreed with her or anything like that, or pushed back, that she's getting chest pain and we're going to give her a heart attack. And she would be like, what would you feel like if I died right now? And this would happen so much that I wouldn't go as far as like saying that I'm happy about it, but I'm glad that she's no longer suffering, because I think deep down, all she was doing was projecting her own insecurities and all this mental health stuff right back onto us. And my dad, who is still like mentally conscious, still to this point has not taken any ownership other than to just blame my mom, which is incredibly unfair because my mom had dementia, couldn't remember stuff, didn't know me for such a long time, which again, I felt that freeing as well. But also, I was mad in the fact that someone could now just forget how much cruelty they have put towards me. And it's also like a door that will always be left open in the sense that it will never, and I would never be able to have a conversation with my mom about what she has done to me, the ramifications that this has had, especially when it comes to me being able to have a stable relationship and dating.
Right, right. Wow. It is so conflicted, right? Just about how to feel about parents. I mean, it sounds really compassionate that you are aware that she was suffering and now she's not suffering anymore, although you suffered quite a bit. And so being able to kind of compartmentalize that and figure out what to do with what you may have needed from her, but that just, you know, still, and you're able to give to her by way of being kind, I think, and really caring about her experience. It's a big deal. That's a big thing to be able to do. And so, right. So here you get to now live your life and you get to talk about your experience. And I'm wondering, besides the fact that we were talking about feeling really triggered by hearing certain sounds or the kind of the decrees, are there other things that you're noticing that are difficult, and that and also, are you noticing that anything has really helped with getting past your experiences?
The amount of things that are triggering is just like so much, because everything, I mean, a group of people sitting in a circle, holding hands, singing, that feels a lot like the, so all this kind of stuff, it's like, so I, a funny thing would be like, I still to this day am a hockey fan, and it's the only way I can kind of talk to my dad. And they started at the end of the game, all the fans were singing Country Road at the same time. Rather than this being like a joyful, fun moment, I'm like, I gotta mute this TV. This is terrible. So it boils back to my name. So the name Uriah is in a lot of religions. And the amount of times when I say my name and someone says, oh, that's a strong Bible name. And all of a sudden they're like, they think this is an invitation to start talking about religion because I must be religious because my name's religious. And I don't think people do that with someone's name is John or Adam. And through kind of me is I joke a lot and almost too much in the sense, and people don't know I'm joking. And that's when I used to pick fights with people with that. And that goes nowhere at all when with a stranger, especially if I'm working like customer service. That doesn't work. But that's where I can use humor instead to like brush it away. And my humor can be confusing. So nothing ends a conversation like a confusing joke with a religious person. It just is over. But that's incredibly triggering. And that's where it's like, that's my identity, so much so that I feel like once I have my show ready and put it out there, this is it. This is who I am. And that is like, I feel like I can then close the chapter on my life. And what I hope then is, and I haven't been able to do this that much as I hope, that once that happens, I can find the right person to kind of talk to and start going through like the actual like medical ways that I can get through it. Now that I talked about it, how can help my social skills, emotional ways, all that kind of stuff. So my younger sister, while I was staying in Santa Barbara, had a violent ex-boyfriend that she had a kid with. And when I was coming back home from a show, I was kind of like sticking up for my younger sister. Like, you can't be here. She had a restraining order on him, all that kind of stuff. So I see him, he's coming to the house. So I told him, you can't be here. And then I go to call 911. And so he's like 6'3". He ends up jumping me and punching me a bunch. I have stitches on my eye now. And when I start screaming for help, that's when he puts me in a chokehold and I lose consciousness. So that's a whole nother thing of like loud noises, all this kind of stuff that triggers that. But my younger sister did the same thing where she just like moved responsibility away from it, even though she ended up saying to me that she wishes that he killed me. And looking back on it, in these near-death experiences, people see lights, all this kind of stuff. And I, to this day, I feel like the worst thing that could have happened was seeing like Elizabeth Clare Prophet or one of the cult doing one of these decrees and being like, oh my God, it's real. Right. And that's where it's like,
right. Yeah.
I'm able to take something that affects me and there's no justice out of it at all. And to this day, just completely unresolved. So that's where like noises and all this kind of stuff, like the idea of, I live in LA, so the idea of driving is I need to make sure to like center myself and like, because it's there's chaos all the time and it's just full of triggers. But it's so weird that this is one of the way the body reacts is by sweating. It's just very funny. But, and then the other thing is you just say to yourself, you're okay. And that is like, because I try, but it feels corny, but now it's just like, just breathe out and just like calm myself. And I slowly, things have gotten better just that way.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Yes. Yes. The body does heat up sometimes. It's through, because of adrenaline. And it's, yeah, often if you're nervous and overwhelmed sensorily. I am so happy. I know we need to wrap it up. I'm so happy to be able to talk to you. It's just quite incredible the journey you have been on since the beginning and that the choices that were made for you in your life were made by others. Now you get to make your own. And it's so nice. And I'm so glad you get to do that and you get to shape your life in a way that reflects you. And that's fantastic. It's so good to meet you. Where can people find out about you and follow you or see your work?
So Instagram, it's Uriah Jokes. And then I'm only on YouTube. Just look up Uriah Westman. I'm on YouTube. And then in terms of my show's at the Lyric Hyperion Theater in Silver Lake in LA. It's May 11th, 7:30. I have the one show right now, but my ticket sales are going pretty good for how much time is left. So most likely I'll do a run of the shows. But that's more or less, that's where you can find me right now.
That's cool that you booked the Hyperion. Awesome. Good job. All righty. I will hopefully talk to you again. And I wish you well with everything and all that you're tackling still in your life and all that you're pursuing. So really, good luck to you.
For sure. Thank you.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Uriah. It is important to hear about someone's experience like his. Somebody who was involved in one group and another and another. So much of what happens when you're young and you're searching and you're trying to find your place, and you're trying to find your place in the world, is that you get disoriented. You really don't know if you can find a place in mainstream life. You might think that you're relegated then to living in this sort of parallel universe. It happens a lot. And I hear from a lot of people who will say, I was raised in something and then brought into something else. And then by the time I could leave it, I didn't know how, and I didn't know how to be, and I didn't know how to get along with people who lived around me but hadn't had my same experiences. There is something about being involved in a cultic system where you really are exposed to kind of a different culture, to different rules, to different language, to different moral code. In fact, one of the things that Uriah talked about is needing to learn compassion. Compassion is not given in cults. You know, because I've been doing this for so long, I just see so much overlap. And you just wonder what that's about, why that happens so often, that there is no compassion. Sometimes there's no compassion for the members of the group. Sometimes the members of the group also learn to have no compassion for people outside the group who haven't decided to open their eyes and open their heart to the truth. And so anyone who seems to be closed off to that doesn't really deserve to have you feel bad for them if something bad happens to them. It's also true, though, within a cultic system that you are sometimes supposed to give compassion to the leader. You're supposed to give permission to the leader. You're supposed to feel like he or she is the victim. If they're arrested or brought up on charges, you're supposed to feel protective towards them in a way that the leader would never feel towards you, ever. And so here, people leave these groups and wonder if it's okay to feel sorry about things, or how does one learn how to feel sorry? How does one learn how to feel guilt? Even though, you know, within the world of psychology, we talk a lot about helping people not have such an overactive guilty conscience, but still, there is some bonus to having some of it if it helps guide you to not hurt others, if it helps guide you to do the right thing, to keep up with your responsibilities, to do something in line with your conscience, to be kind. One of the things also that we talk about is that a sense of humor is something that is really not at all fostered in a cultic system. And if you came into it with a sense of humor, that's going to be gone pretty fast. I know I've talked about this in the past, but sometimes when people ask me how I know if my child or my loved one is involved in something like a cult or is involved in a relationship that's not healthy for them, I will often say to look for certain signs, one of which is a shift in a sense of humor. When people are down, when they're stressed, when they're depressed, they will lose their sense of humor. When people also are so conflicted about if it's okay to say anything and if it's okay to make a joke about anything, then they don't take the risk and they don't exhibit their sense of humor. And part of the reason this is that a cult leader will want you to be busy doing the important work and talking about important things, and a sense of humor is sort of a waste of time. And it's considered silly and frivolous. But also, I think part of the reason that this is fostered within cultic systems is that a cult leader often has no sense of humor. They are all too self-important. And they have their feelings hurt so easily that it is very easy for them to think you are laughing at them. And so people don't take that risk within a cult. They don't take that risk when they're in a relationship with someone who has a narcissistic bent to them. Something else that I was thinking about while Uriah was talking is that sometimes people will say to me, oh, I heard a particular cult group doesn't exist anymore. And I will often think to myself, I'm not sure about that. Like Church Universal and Triumphant might not exist with the same name. Elizabeth Clare Prophet, the person who started it and was running it, might not be doing the work that she's doing to the same degree. But I don't doubt that there is some offshoot. I don't doubt that there is sort of Church Universal and Triumphant 2.0 somewhere. Because often, you might have a cult leader who was brought up on charges or who becomes kind of infamous because of what they're known for in connection with this group. So they often don't learn from that if they are brought up on charges or if people are harmed by them. They just learn how to hide what they're doing better. And one of the first ways they do that is either by changing their name or by changing the name of the group. And there are also people who are part of their family who have learned how to do this by being in it. Of course, with Elizabeth Clare Prophet, she has her daughter, Erin, who has luckily, gratefully, gone the very other direction, opposite direction, and actually speaks at cult-related conferences, thank goodness. But I think that what also happens is that there are people in leadership of cults who, once a cult is gone, they're thinking, I don't want to stop having this power, or I believe in the mission, I believe in the teaching, so I'm just going to start things up in my own way. And so I keep watch, even if a group seems like it has disbanded, just because it might have popped up in a different version of itself and is still potentially just as harmful. And so Uriah got involved in an offshoot called the Heart Center. And then he went to Canada and got involved in something called the Ideal Society, which seems unrelated, but still, these names are so interesting to me, from Church Universal and Triumphant, which would give you this kind of feeling that the people there are really having this triumphant kind of experience when they're just really being beaten down, made to be panicked, made to be afraid of the leadership, made to be afraid of ever disappointing her, made to be afraid of ever leaving the teachings, the confines of the group, and have been able to be hypnotized en masse, which Elizabeth Clare Prophet was very good at doing. That's hardly a triumphant moment, except just for her. And then to have an offshoot called the Heart Center, also ironic for how much people were so destroyed in this group, but also how Uriah talked about needing to learn to feel compassion. Interesting that a place like the Heart Center, you're not going to be taught compassion. You can never trust a name when it is connected to a cult group. The name is usually going to be an overcompensation for what it isn't and what it doesn't provide and what it doesn't care about. Thank you so much to Uriah for sharing with us today your journey. And we all wish you well in your career, in coming forward, in talking about your experiences. Take good care, everyone. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.